I'm Louise Ferguson. I'm the next talk. And now we're going to move away from strict disciplinary, and I'm going to tell you some of the fun you can have in horticulture by traveling the world. Title of my talk, I borrowed it from Dr. Seuss, Oh, the Places You'll Go as a Horticulturist. I'd like to start by saying St. Augustine, over 1,500 years ago, said the world is a book, and those who do not travel have read only one page. For me, that's been true. Okay. In preparation for this talk, I just sat down and wrote off the top of my head the countries that my job has taken me to. In 1984, I became an extension specialist at the University of California in Davis. And since then, between meetings, research cooperations, and other opportunities, USAID projects, other projects, I've been to over 70 countries and counting. And the meetings, of course, have taken me to many of the states in the United States. So I'm going to start by showing you a few of the places that are a few of the things I do when I travel. So when I travel for my work, the objectives are usually meetings. It's research cooperations. The meetings would be primarily International Society of Horticultural Science, specifically the working groups. They meet like every 4 years, 100, 125 people, a good chance to see significant research done. And over the years I've been attending them, these friends have become my colleagues, and I've even seen some of their children now become professors. I've worked with research cooperations, specifically mechanical harvesting of olives in Spain, Argentina, done development projects for USAID. My beat has been primarily Iraq, then Afghanistan and Pakistan. Is that thing blinking? Is this blinking up here? And generally, you know, one of the things you learn if you do a development project, you don't get invited to rich places. It's some place that needs your help. Sabbatical. Take your sabbaticals. I've had colleagues brag to me they haven't taken their sabbaticals. I only feel sorry for them. I've had wonderful ones in Spain. Spain took one in Florida, in Australia, and in Palermo, Sicily. And then there is consulting. I only do it for institutions at the cost, but they've taken me some wonderful places. Since I'm usually the person behind the camera, I don't have many pictures of myself, but this is the kinds of things I do when I'm on traveling. For many of my projects, I'm evaluating orchards. Here I'm evaluating olives in Egypt. I establish orchards. Here we are with the Mercy Corps trying to get a young pistachio orchard started in near Herat, Afghanistan. Teach classes. Here I am with one of my classes in Herat, Afghanistan. These are all young men that are going to be extension agents. Do cooperative research. Here I am with some of my Spanish colleagues investigating a canopy contact mechanical olive harvester that we also hope to use as a mummy knocker for almonds to get the end later for larger pistachio trees. And we do capacity building. Here I am with a group in Pakistan with a colleague from Lebanon trying to demonstrate to people how to do basic post-harvest. So now what I'm going to do, instead of showing you more pictures, is I'm going to plug for one of my favorite projects, a project I discovered in Afghanistan. It's called Improving Afghanistan's Pistachio Production. In my trips to Afghanistan, one of the things that I discovered is not only, and I was there with USAID projects to increase their extension capacity, but one of the projects I discovered was that they have a wild pistachio industry. And every year they have a community harvest called the Shola Pist. And basically, this project, I chased around for years trying to find where these wild pistachio orchards were, and I finally found one up in Mazar El Sharif, up in the Balkh province of Afghanistan. I hope you can see this. These small dots are basically the orchard in the distance. As you get closer, you can see it's just down in the lee of the mountains where the snow melt, would irrigate the orchard just enough in the spring to get fruits set and encourage really deep roots. So these are all seedling trees. It's a wild forest. Get a little closer, looks like that. Get a little closer. These trees, what really impressed me the first time I saw them was how healthy they look. For something that's grown totally wild, totally untended, they're very healthy. Get a little closer, they look like this. Get a little closer and they had very nice looking nuts. Not something that I would expect in a wild orchard. And some nice looking cultivars. This is up near the Tajikistan border. And doing this and reading some of the literature, I found out that Tajikistan-Afghanistan border is one of the original locations of pistachio germplasm. So the Sholapist is the traditional harvest before the bad times in Afghanistan, before the Russians, and before the Taliban. The villagers organized, they hired what you would call a ranger, and he guarded the trees to make sure nobody harvested them. Then when it's time for harvest, the local headman would call the harvest. The village participates in the harvest. The harvest is distributed by mosque membership proportionally. And then they dry the pistachios, hull on, hull off sometimes. And then they're purchased by a nut broker who cracks a small sample, discovers how many of them are full or blanks. That's one of the ways we do quality of pistachios, what size the nuts are inside. And then hires female villagers to crack these nuts open because they are unirrigated and most of them are not sold split like the American pistachios because we have more water. The best nuts go for export to India and Pakistan. I'll explain later why they can't go into the EU. And the halves, the broken nuts, they're sold for the domestic market. Okay, that's the village headman. These are the women sitting under the trees before harvest. I wasn't there during the harvest season, but somebody loaned me this picture. They're delivered to the processor like this, dried with the hull on, or they can scrape the hulls off with a little screen like this, and deliver them to the processor like this. And then this little lady has been given, after the nuts have been sold to the processor, and he figures out what the percentage of filled nuts are in there, because that determines the value, he basically brings them back to these women who use these two little rocks. And here, I'll try and do this with my finger. Well, you see the rocks in the picture there? When I went, they gave them hammers and anvils, I think, to impress me. But these women basically get two little rocks, and all day they put the nut on edge and they crack it open. Base down, tip up, crack it open, flip off those piles of shells you see, and crack out the kernels. Then there's a headman showing some of their export product. But something like this will cost 1,300 ats, about 18 euros per kilo, sold to Pakistan and Afghanistan. When they get lesser quality, they go down a little bit in price, but these are still pretty good looking. That purple integument skin is still on them. Lower quality, go down in price, but still pretty decent price. Now you're starting to see splits, a little bit of damage in them. The integument broke and sold for a lower price. Then the really lower price was 630 apps, like eight euros a kilo, are sold locally. So one of the things I was interested in doing was taking this industry to a place other than India and Pakistan. Currently, to enter the EU, pistachios have to have an aflatoxin tolerance. It's about 1 ppb. To do that, you have to test for aflatoxin contamination in your country. Afghanistan has a lab. I'm not sure who set it up for them. I visited it. It's obviously never been used, so they have no aflatoxin tolerance. They cannot enter the EU. Occasionally Arab countries, like the UAE, buy their nuts, but they're mostly sold to India and Pakistan at a greatly decreased price because they can enter no other markets and the rest is domestic. And this is very low-hanging fruit. I saw this industry and realized if they could get into Europe, you know, what sells something is the story. And basically, this organically grown wild forest, hand-harvested and cracked by the lady villagers, native varieties. I kept telling them, you've got to, they have no plant breeding rights in Afghanistan, but I kept telling them, you have to do this, because you could name these things like the green gold of Pakistan. The story would sell these nuts, plus with their dryland horticulture, they're quite highly flavored, and they're lovely to look at, as you saw with the green color. So some of the very low-hanging fruit here is that I could teach them to harvest at the proper time, so they had more filled nuts, maybe some split ones, and I could teach them how to harvest so they wouldn't break the branches, which they do, and then remove the budwood because these nuts are apically born. And the other thing we could do to help these forests is they're about 50% female. Pistachios only need about one male to 25 females, and actually in locations where there's a couple males, they could be like Iran, like 1 in 50. So it would be very easy to increase the proportion of female trees here and increase the yield in these wild forests. So basically it would be very easy to teach them to harvest at the proper time. Since they harvest by hand, they could be more selective and look for nuts, like the one in the center here, that demonstrates it's starting to be ripe and filled by that slightly split, softer skin. And we could improve the forest by just watching some of the trees, collecting the better quality nuts the year before, because these are all seedling trees. So all we have to do is look for the clusters that have a higher percentage of filled split nuts, larger nuts, any quality of a more highly colored nut, because the green sells. They could very easily do their own evaluation, cut back some branches, get some vegetative growth, get the budded wood, or get the female budwood, and then go out into the orchard, which, like I said, is 50% female. I just explained how they would cut back a tree to get the cultivar they want, get the buds, and then there's lots of little volunteers growing in the orchard. If we waited for those volunteers to grow up, 1 in 2 chance of being male or female, but if we irrigated these things just a little bit, to increase the slipping of the cambium, these could be budded over to females and increase the proportion of females in the orchard. So showing how easy it is to do. Pistachios have a very extended juvenility. It takes them 8 to 10 years in an unirrigated situation to come to bearing. I just explained the marketing to Europe. They cannot get in because they don't have aflatoxin testing. They could have it, but it would take somebody like Mercy Corps or a USAID project to set up the lab and teach them how to test for aflatoxin. But I still think it should be pursued because it's low-hanging fruit, and I know they could get 40 euros per kilo for something with a story like this. The traditional harvest, organic, village identification. But the problem is that they don't have aflatoxin testing, and aflatoxin is spread in the orchard by the split nut. It proliferates more. It's an endemic pathogen, Aspergillus niger and flavus, that generates the liver toxin, aflatoxin. And it often originates in the early splits in the orchard. They have so much hand labor there, they could go out and tweak off those splits and decrease their aflatoxin level. Are the letters showing up? Not very well. Oh, good. Okay. And then here's just showing you other nuts that they could remove that would decrease the early splits. Okay. The other way that they could increase the pistachio production in Afghanistan is I discovered pistachio species, again, just seedlings, are being used in afforestation projects on hills where they don't want to lose the soil. They have developed pistachios as a tree to prevent this. All those long lines you see there are basically deeply dug trenches with little cul-de-sacs. You can see the deep trench, how deep it is. It's almost 2/3 of a meter with those cutouts at intervals. And each of those cutouts is a little seedling pistachio tree. And basically, again, we could go in and bud these just like we bud a regular orchard. They could be budded to a higher percentage of females, because all these little seedlings, again, one in two chance being a male or a female. So again, we could just bud them and produce a higher percentage of females in the orchard. Okay? So that's one of the another way, because those wild afforestation projects are near villages. All they would have to do to keep those pistachios in a producing state is to control the goats. And the goats are largely herd of it. The goats do like to get up in the tree. Then, the other thing they can do in Afghanistan is they can develop cultivated orchards. And just by happenstance, I was on a plane. I met a soccer player from the Afghan national team, and he had the only established, what we would call an established pistachio orchard in Afghanistan. I've seen that they can grow good cherries there. If they can grow good cherries, they can grow a good pistachio. It's a whole lot less problem. But here I am up in Herat again, giving a budding demonstration, which I thought was really silly, because many of the Afghans were the Mexicans of Iran during the really bad times of the Taliban. And they went to Iran, were the field workers, and came back with knowledge and budwood. So here we have a nursery that we started with seedling rootstocks, because they're very well adapted to Afghanistan. And we're holding a budding training. And I was brought there to do a budding training, which was ridiculous, because when I got there, they basically had a much better budding technique than I do. We do a T-bud. We basically just make a vertical cut, and a horizontal cut, then a vertical cut, pry it open, slip in the budwood without the wood in, just cambium to cambium. What they do often in Iran is they do what we call ring budding. They take away all the bark, tip a branch, take away all of the bark, then take the budwood, take a ring off, like that, get maximum cambium, and put it on the end, the rubber thing. It's beautiful, it's actually better than ours, and it's ridiculous that they have me over there to train them. One, I don't have good hands for budding, and two, they were doing it better than I could. So those are the ways that I was hoping, and I was able to pitch to the then Minister of Agriculture, that you can have a wonderful industry on all levels here. You can have a cultivated orchards with the guys that have money and have skin in the game. And frankly, you don't need me from California. Right across the border is Iran, with all kinds of expertise in cultivars. But, you know, they seem to want us. There are the traditional orchards, which are the wild orchards, where I think they could get high value for very low input. They just need an aflatoxin lab. They have the reforestation orchards that could be like the wild orchards. And then kitchen gardens. People can have one or two trees in their garden. It's a good source of protein. The pistachios keep well. And it's a part of their thousands of years of tradition. The other thing I'm urging them very strongly to do is they have no plant breeding rights in Afghanistan. And I keep telling them, you have to collect these things and start to test them and claim them as your own before some plant explorer does it, or at least get them identified with your country. Even if somebody else has them, at least you have them with your name under them. It would be a great marketing campaign. Now I'll show you some of the fun parts of this trip. I was also evaluating some of their cultivars at Bottom Bomb, which is the field station in Kabul. The man across there in the tie looking at me, he's a very interesting man. He's an engineer who came back to Afghanistan in Kabul, became the mayor of Kabul after the bad times, after the Taliban left, and he invited me there to help develop pistachios. So there we are at a photo opportunity, and they took me on a little trip around Kabul. One of the things they took me to was I got into the palace complex in Kabul. I was told I was the first American to be invited in there. There's three palaces in the complex. This is the oldest one. I don't have too many pictures because the guards told me I couldn't take pictures, so I just waited till they weren't around. But this was the first one. And then I did get a picture inside the palace, is what it looks like. The grounds were beautiful. Then we traveled outside Afghanistan, and you know, when you land at the Kabul airport, or when you're going around Afghanistan, everything is sort of this silty brown color, the houses, the ground, once you're outside Kabul. But the vegetation seems to grow very well where they do have water, and interestingly enough, it's just not tamed, but Afghanistan actually has pretty good mountain water sources. We had to have lots of photo opportunities. This was always what they, this is the kind of picture they took. This is what has always looked like to me looking back when people would take our pictures. Okay. They took me up to the Summer Palace that is in the mountains overlooking Kabul. It's a beautiful, large edifice, and it looks back over the lake into Kabul. And this is usually the way we traveled around. I never felt unsafe in Afghanistan at all, really, but they do make you travel around like this, and so it's kind of interesting to look back and forward and see all those trucks with the machine guns mounted. And one of the things that's really interesting about the guards is they love flowers. They always wanted me to take their pictures in the flowers, so I would oblige them to take their pictures in the flowers. And the other thing is, every time we got near water, they wanted to wash their Humvees. So I wanted to take a picture of them doing it, but I pretended. We were visiting cherry orchards. They had some really very good quality cherry orchards due to the nice dry climate and the high elevation. So I pretended I was taking a picture of those cherries so I could get a picture of them washing their Humvees. Okay. And I'll end with this. Wherever I go, I try to blend in. This is the traditional outfit that the women in Kabul wear. And I bought one and I wore it around a little bit and I felt like I blended in. And that's my presentation. I'll take questions if anybody has any. Thank you very much. No questions? Yes? Very good question. I was asked, how receptive are people to my input? And one of the things I've learned as a person who travels to maybe see situations is I just sit and listen until people ask me a question. And what I've learned is that people are really, really happy to tell you what they do. And I have to say, I've gotten my best research ideas from traveling. I never would have started working with salinity tolerance at pistachio rootstocks had I not been to Iran. It gave me a major research benefit. People are very receptive, but I always start by complimenting them on what they do and telling them how I've learned something. And carry a lot of pictures. I design my PowerPoints when I'm in these countries for what you would call illiterate people, meaning I don't have any words, just pictures. Because I find it's easier for people to understand. But my current beat, you know, as I said, moved from Iraq to Afghanistan to Pakistan, and I felt very well received. And people are quite receptive. Now I'm trying to take more of my own growers to these countries because sometimes our growers think they know everything, and you get someplace, and if you just look, you see other people. You know, these countries have been growing pistachios and olives for thousands of years. They have to know something. With less tools than we have. Sir?
As captain, safety comes, what advice do you have?
The question was, as times change, safety becomes a big concern, and how did I handle it in these countries? So when you go with these USAID projects or with other institutions, they generally handle all your arrangements, and I just go along with what they say. But I've always found I feel safer when we travel low profile, you know, rather than the UN vehicle that has aerials sprouting everywhere and says, shoot at me, as far as I'm concerned. I would rather just travel in a beat-up Toyota. If probably the only thing I would say now, and I used to go out on the streets alone, even in just a scarf and raincoat, Western dress. I would say that I just prefer to travel low profile in smaller groups, you know, not look too imposing. But I've never felt threatened. I have to say, one time in the Punjab, because of the problems in the Kashmir, they gave me a security detail, and they had these black T-shirts on, and on the front it said SWAT team, and then they turned around and on the back it said no fear. So if you get an opportunity to travel to any of these countries, I encourage you to do it first, because I always learn something. And one other caution, if you start to do international work and you travel to other countries, the one thing you must have prepared is how this is going to look to your clientele, your growing industry. And the very first time I got asked, you know, what are you doing over in, this was China, giving away our secrets, I bobbled the question badly. And I had to go back and rethink this and realize that you have to, when you're confronted like this, and it will be always in an arena where you have to remain unthreatened, let them know that you always learn something that you can bring back. That these people have been growing these trees successfully, maybe not the yields we have because we don't have the water we have, but these people know something because they have a sustainable crop they've been growing with less tools. So if you go into international work, be prepared, as I see, for the, as I call it, the Wall Street Journal rule. Don't do anything you wouldn't want to see written on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, or New York Times, or your local paper, for that matter. But be prepared to demonstrate what value you get from this and what value you bring back. As I said, I got some of my best research ideas seeing how they grow pistachios in Iran. And I encourage all of you to do international work. I found Seymour Gundy, the dean of a nematologist and dean at Riverside, said horticulture is a small world. And that's what I found out. I have friends all over the world, and we're sort of the same small community. We've now known each other for two and a half generations. I see some of their children coming into the field. So please, go international places and then come back and report what you've seen at your American Society of Horticultural Science. And join our sister organization, the International Society of Horticultural Science, and attend those sub-work group meetings. They're nice small meetings, 125, 150 people. They're held every 4 years. That's long enough for real research to get done, so there's real progress. And that group becomes your family within that crop over the years. I've attended the citrus, the fig, the pistachio, and the olive oil. And they've all been wonderful experiences. So I encourage all of you, take advantage of international experiences. The session yesterday had multiple websites where you can find these experiences. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming.